bird.
It's a plane.
More filled to the brim with creamy goodness than my pants after watching the Dark Knight Rises prologue on IMAX, it's the Off-Panel Podcast, the comic show where the tensions are high and the ink is fresh. I'm John Lees, and I'm joined by Alex Campbell.
Hi.
Yes. And we're joined by the elusive rarity that is Mercy Mueller.
Hi.
And this is a show where some chums gather round and talk comics. I'm using chums this week instead of buddies. What do you think? I think sounds that good. You notice we're a bit thin today because we're missing our glorious leader, Sergio. I'm afraid to say that Sergio died after being shagged to death by Matt. And Matt isn't with us either because he's in jail for the crime. So he was left to carry the torch of comics geekery onward.
You know, I'd like to say it was a surprise, but no, I think we all saw it coming.
Yeah, you like
that. Yeah, yeah. So. The signs were all there.
And so did Matt.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Did anyone have any interesting weeks to report?
Oh, yeah, I had a very exciting week.
Oh, wow, let's see it.
No, I didn't have
one. Oh, you got my hopes up there, Alex.
I know, I was like, really? Oh, never mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's me.
Well, no one cares about you anyway. We had a reprise of Hurricane Bobag. It came back a second time. You know how these things do come in pairs.
It came back for revenge.
But yeah, so we had some more of that. In the midst of that, as I say, I went to see the Dark Knight Rises prologue, but we'll be talking about that later on. Just today I went to this book signing event. It was some Glasgow small press thing. And I'm quite pleased with the fact that by sheer force of attrition and quite against as well, I seem to have become a vague acquaintance of Frank Quietly, purely because we always end up at the same social events of like comics pros in Glasgow. I just get to the point now where it can we kind of know each other's faces, like, oh, again, but we don't really know each other.
It's like you're always on the opposite end of the room.
Oh, sorry, what was that?
It's like you're always on the opposite ends of the room or something.
Yeah, it's like I'm stuck, you know. What about you, Mercy? Do you have anything interesting going on?
Nothing really interesting happened this week. We had our first snowfall of the year, and that's about it.
All right, snow's good. When it falls, then when it becomes slush and ice. That was the other thing after I left the book signing. I said my goodbyes to the luminaries of the Scottish comic scene and turned around and almost slipped and fell on my face in black ice. Which would have been a nice exit.
Sporting a shiner.
Yeah. that's the bit I don't like. The black ice and the cold and misery. So yeah, anybody get any good comics this week?
Oh, I got a few.
I only ever buy good comics.
That's a good of your life, I see.
I got kind of a mixed bag this week, actually.
So any standouts you thought were good?
I'll let Mercy go first.
Yeah, ladies first.
Oh, is it me?
Yep.
Oh my goodness. Anything really outstanding? I have to say DC this week was kind of a wash. And I guess I can go into that later with you guys once you tell me what you watched. I mean, what you read.
What we watched.
What
I like
you watched.
To watch my comics.
I like to watch my comics too. Actually, the comics that I've been most impressed with have been the ones where I can sort of see how they could be a television show. And one of the ones that came out this week that was really amazing that I really liked was Image Comics Blue Estate number 8. And have any of you ever heard of this?
Is that the kind of noir one?
It is amazing. In fact, I don't know where Matt is. He would love it. Like, they parody so many things. Like, the first, I actually went back because this was number 8. So I went back and I got the first 7. They parody, like, Law and Order, and there's Dexter references in there that's hilarious. And it's just a really, it's kind of noir, but it's set in modern day times, and it's just crazy fun. I love it. And the art is awesome.
Cool. I've heard good things about it since it started. It's just one of these things I've never gotten to trying.
You need to try it. You should look into it. And then, And then I read, I don't know how we're doing this.
Go through all your list and tell us your thoughts, then we'll pick up after you. We don't, but it's because it's so rare to have you on the show. We like hearing your voice as much as possible when you're here.
Okay. And then I read another comic by a not Marvel or DC. I read, oh my goodness, who publishes it? The Jingle Bell gift wrap single. It was a one-shot.
Oh, it's a Paul Dini
character. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure, like, I was reading it, and I'm like, wow, this art looks really familiar. I feel like I've read this before. Like, the characters felt familiar. So I'm pretty sure back in the day I picked up another one of his holiday-themed ones. But it was, like, a ton of fun, because there's not... You don't really a lot of times get that kind of Christmas cheer in comics a whole lot. And when you do, it's always like a downer, super depressed, rah, rah, rah kind of a thing. So it was kind of fun to read something that was really peppy and cheerful and colorful and got you in the Christmas mood.
I think it's some people are cynical about Christmas. So I think it's people having some fun with it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to read. And then I also picked up Orchid number 3, which is a Dark Horse comic. Have any of you heard of that one?
No, I can't say. I have recognized the name, I think, but I've never read it or looked into it.
Yeah, well, this is only the third one, and I didn't go back and get the first two, but I want to, because it's really interesting. It's kind of like an alternate world, and the animals are evil. All you need to...
All right, okay.
And there's something about this mask that will either kill you or... It's very interesting. I definitely want to go read them again. But all in all, I'm really liking a lot of the stuff that Image and Dark Horse are putting out.
Yeah, it's quite cool stuff. We'll be talking more about that later on, I believe, just how cool Image is in general. But did you read any Big Two stuff this week, or did you avoid it all, or what did you do?
I read Suicide Squad, Batgirl, Batwoman, Superboy, and Resurrection Man.
All right, okay. And would you like any of them, or were they disappointing?
Well, did any of you guys read any of them?
I read, out of those ones, I read Batwoman and Batgirl.
Same with me, actually.
So, yeah, maybe if you mention them, we can all just chip in with our thoughts on Batwoman and Batgirl.
Well, I know Alex didn't read Suicide Squad, because I was reading it, and he was like, you poor woman. And I was like,
It's true. It's true.
It wasn't that bad.
Well, you subject yourself to it so we don't have to. We admire you for that.
I subject myself to so many things for you guys.
Yeah, I guess I didn't really think it bad, that you know? Way.
It wasn't that bad. There were four panels in the book. It totally worth it. The shading and the expression, the art for it was perfect, and like the movement through the panels were amazing. And that salvaged this particular issue for me. There's always been a little something in each one of the issues that I found that have sort of like salvaged it for me and made me want to read what, you know, the next issue would be.
Everything I hear about Suicide Squad just makes me sad. It just makes me want to cry.
Well, I never read any of the other ones though. I think I read maybe one from like the 80s or something, or maybe it was the early 90s. I don't know, and it didn't really impress me at the time.
I'll have a list of horrific crimes against comics. Like, we have Amanda Waller's not fat anymore, made her skinny.
that was surprising. We see more of Waller in this one, which was interesting. Also learned the power of a guy that we were introduced to in issue 3, and I told Alex what it was, and his reaction was pretty much exactly what mine was. It's Bouncing Boy.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, it's Bouncing Boy.
He can manipulate his mass, apparently. And all I could think of was like him just bouncing up and down like a hall of like the Legion of Superheroes headquarters or something.
I like that. I think it'd be quite good.
I liked his name, though, is totally... It's a total play on, like, the whole yo-yo dieting thing. And I was like, really, really? That's the best you could come up with, was name a guy whose code name is Yo-Yo, and he can change his weight at will.
So I think the problem with Amanda Waller, it's easily retconned because at the end of this first art, Suicide Squad had a disastrous failure, and Amanda Waller starts comfort eating. And starts eating pies and burgers, and she just starts deadly putting on weight again over the course of, you know. And she says, that gastric bad was for nothing. And she's back.
It's like you always see her with fat. Like you always see her with food all over her face. It's
that's terrible.
From her chin, you know, and she's giving her this.
Come on now. You guys should be... She's a strong presence. She's not a nice female presence, but she's a strong female presence. So...
She was strong when she was fat.
What's wrong with you? And come here.
I'm a chubby.
I admit, out of that entire book, the one thing you're focused on is that she's not fat. I think there are kind of other things you need to focus on besides that.
Yeah.
Deadshot doesn't have a mustache anymore.
Yeah, he does. He doesn't. And the storyline, I don't know how the original Suicide Squad was, but it feels like it feels really fast. Like, oh yeah, we did this mission, and then next issue we're in this mission now, and it's kind of like, oh, this is, like, it moves really fast, and it seems really super compressed, and there's not, like, a lot of character development, but maybe I'm just used to team books where the team actually likes each other.
To me, it's bad enough that it's not a good book in its own right, but it's the fact that it's not a good book that has retconned not only all of the Suicide Squad, which was acclaimed and celebrated and influential, and retconned the Secret Six stuff out of existence as well, which was the best thing DC was putting out before the relaunch, pretty much. It just real sadness, I think. It's a shame.
Yeah.
Aww.
So what about females? What do you think of those books?
For Batgirl and Batwoman?
Yep. We'll start with Batgirl.
Well, I'll start with Batwoman.
All right, okay. Just to be contradictory, because I said start with Batgirl. Okay.
Oh, did you? I'm sorry. I have a lot to say about Batgirl, and I know someone else has a lot to say about her, too, so...
Right, on you go with Batman.
Make up your mind. So which one am I using? Which one are we talking about first?
We'll go with Batwoman, because that's who you wanted to go with. We'll say Batwoman.
Okay. Oh, yeah, Batwoman, which continually amazes me. I really liked it this week. The focus on Flamebird, who's a character you don't see a lot. It was basically, the book this week was basically like a tie together. It was like, I don't want to say, well, maybe. I would say it's a filler issue that's basically tying two things together. It was a setup for something else and a continuation of another storyline. So, I can't say much about the writing, but...
What I really want to do is I want to read all of this art once it's finished. I want to read it all in one sitting. I think when you read it all in one sitting, it's going to be amazing. And these single issue installments, it feels like every month I'm just getting really into it, and it ends. It goes back too quick.
But it might be just because you're enjoying it so much.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Because I can't really complain, like, you know, because some issues, like 20 pages feels like forever. But this one, like, you know, as I say, like, you're breezing through it, and every issue, that's not the last page already, is it? So maybe that's a good sign. And there was lots of nice touches in this issue. I loved the opening sequence where you had, like, the tender, soft focus and a love scene interspersed with this really hard-hitting, violent fight scene, and the colour scheme was contrasting between them. And you had some great character beats, like when Flamebird is captured and she thinks she's in the hospital and that she's dying. It's like, who would you like to call? It was just a really nice, like, moment of manipulation by these shady CIA suits. And I'm really interested where that arc's going. The main storyline with the haunted woman in the water is a bit by the numbers, and I think what really interests me in this book is the subplots and the character dynamics between everyone that's going on in the background. That's what really engages me, I think.
Yeah.
And Kate Kane's a great character, a great design by J.H. Williams. Well, he didn't design her, but he draws her really well. And the character, like, is getting really interesting development too. And I like how it's quietly becoming an ensemble book with Flamebird and with Maggie Sawyer and with the CIA people. And
yeah, Agent Cameron Chase.
Yeah, Cameron Chase, that's her name. And it's a cast of female characters, you know. So there's no token woman or anything. All these characters, you know, are diverse and have their own traits and personalities. It's a great book, I think, for female readers as well. And I think, like, what I see is interesting. It's not just Batwoman anymore. It's a whole ensemble book, and I think it's a grower, because it wasn't something that ranked among my favourites the first couple of months, but quietly it's getting higher and higher in my read list when it comes to reading the new books I've bought every week.
I think what the best thing about it is that every week I felt like it's presented, like, more and more character development than the other books. Like for me, for some reason that I really can't explain, it seems like whenever I read it, it honestly, like, gives, like, a naturalistic, organic character development, which I really admire.
I'm just really digging the Batwoman character right now. I think, maybe this is a bit premature, but I think Batwoman would be a really interesting character to see DC try adapting into a movie, because although it's part of the Batman franchise, so it's got an inbuilt audience, but she's not really dependent on Batman at all, like a lot of the other spin-off characters are. And there's a lot of scope for her to have her own mythology.
Which is kind of a really clever way to go, considering, you look at a character like Batwoman, you automatically assume, well, she's basically there to be in Batman's shadow. But no, they've gone the opposite route with her.
And it's not just horror or the fact that she has her own supporting cast, but even the stories, the fact that they're more supernatural, is a whole different area of Gotham, pretty much.
A place that they've actually tried with Batman a couple of times, but it hasn't really worked out for whatever reason.
She's got a right good niche going on, I think, and it's interesting to see how that flourishes in future issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd want to have a Batwoman movie, because so much of Batwoman for me is the art.
Yeah, J.H. Williams. It's funny because it's hard to think that other artists drew Batwoman before J.H. Williams took over, because he's just made it his character so much.
Yeah, he has kind of reinvented it.
Yeah. And so much... Sorry, I'll let you go first.
I love his art, just because literally whenever I open the book, and I can say this as a female, but whenever I open the book, the first thing I notice, I'm like, oh my goodness, he got the boobs right. which, as a female, that's kind of a big deal. Like, generally, you're used to seeing, these idealized women drawn in comics, and you just kind of like, oh yeah, whatever. Then I open up Batwoman, every month, and I'm like, oh my gosh, look at those boobs!
it's not right. Guys, it's okay to open up a book with a female character, and the first thing you say is, well, I'll look at those boobs, because women say that as well.
I said it was okay because I'm a female.
So only women are allowed to appreciate the boobs in a Batwoman comic?
They should, I think so. The realism in the boobs.
It's your duty as a woman to appreciate boobs. But yeah, I'm starting to think now, because the first month I enjoyed Batgirl more, but I think Batwoman's starting to overtake Batgirl for me, just steadily over the... I think this month was the month that it overtook. I'm still enjoying Batgirl as well, but Batwoman to me is becoming a real grower.
Yeah. I have to... Honestly, Batwoman is probably one of my favorite books of the DC relaunch. It's remained that way for me from the beginning, which is a little different from what everyone thought, but, it grabbed me, because it felt like, it's a book that started with Greg Rucka, and it felt like Rucka never left. That's kind of their writing style, which I've been saying for a while.
Kudos to J.H. Williams, because as amazing as it is to say for someone of Greg Rucka's talent, but you don't miss Greg Rucka. The changeover's been seamless.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have.
So how does Batgirl compare? How do we say what were our thoughts on Batgirl this issue?
Alex, would you like to start?
I liked it. I like reading it every week. It's just that every time I read it, I sort of forget that I've read it, and then I move on to other books, and then eventually it just comes to the week that Batgirl comes out, and I say to myself, oh yeah, I'm picking that up, which I don't know if that's good or bad, because I still enjoy it when I read it. It's just that it's not very memorable.
Well, here's something interesting with me, what my experience is with Batgirl. It seems every month, right, as I go through this cycle where I read Batgirl and really enjoy it, and that was a really good read. Then I'll go online and everyone's saying, oh, Batgirl sucks, it's crap. And over the weeks I start to think, well, really, was it that good? Maybe I'm wrong, maybe it does suck. And that's my opinion of it starts to go down over the weeks. And then I read the next issue, and they go, oh, that was good, that was actually good. You know, I was right after all, and I enjoy it again. It seems to just go through that whole process, wash, wind, rinse, and repeat.
Are they really saying that about that? I don't read, I admit, I don't go to the forums as often as I should, so I don't know what people are saying.
The continuity cadets don't like it.
Okay, well, I'm trying to figure out how to say this, and because it really... I read it last night. I read number 4 last night, and I love Batgirl. She was one of my first, she was one of the first characters I really latched on to in DC, and I love Simone, to death. Simone's amazing. But I was reading last night, and I had I got to the point, like, halfway through the book where I was like, Simone is... I don't like this book anymore. It's not interesting. The book, like, number four was so over the top. And it felt like it was trying too hard. It feels like Simone is trying too hard to make Batgirl a presence and her own thing and super important in the DC universe or in the DC new universe. And I'm just not into that right now.
Yeah, I think
at all.
I think what you mentioned yesterday when we were talking was that Barbara is trying a little too hard to stand out on her own, and it's kind of dumb because she's kind of stuck in a pattern where she's always mulling over the same thing in every issue. Like,
yeah, it's the exact same thing every issue. This, like, survivor guilt, and it's kind of like, I am okay with, you know, them mentioning it maybe once, but on issue four with her still mulling over, like, oh, I'm still alive and da-da-da-da and I can walk.
And you only,
it's like,
use it so much.
Oh my gosh, just get it up, woman. And then at the end when she was talking to Mirror about, you know, like, sometimes bad things happen, and I don't even remember, I will admit, I don't remember exactly what she said that much, but it was like, yeah, okay, Barbara, we get it. Do you get it yet? Do you? And it's just frustrating. Unless something really amazing happens in that book, I don't know.
Do you think you're gonna be dropping it soon then?
I pretty much do what, like, I kind of do what Alex does. I picked up issue four and I started reading it, and I literally had forgotten what happened in issue three. I was like, she's fighting the Mirror? Who's Mirror? I don't remember this guy. Where'd he come from?
I actually forgot how issue three ended. I was reading thinking she's on the wheelchair and she's having the dream sequence. I thought, how did issue three end again? And then I only remembered later on that it all ended with that weird conversation with Nightwing.
Yeah, and I actually had to go back and reread number three to figure out what was going on number four. And I guess, I don't know, for me, it was disheartening to realize all this because I love Simone. And I was kind of like, I feel like Simone should be writing better than this, because I know she can.
I'm still sad that Secret Six is gone.
I agree. I love the Secret Six. It's probably one of my favorite books.
May be something that kind of suffers as far as... That may be something that makes Batgirl suffer, is that it's not an ensemble piece like Secret Six, because one of the great things about Secret Six is you have so many different voices coming out at each other. Like, you have so many different characters.
Oh, maybe that's it, because Simone does really well in the team books. Like,
yeah.
If you have
as well.
Characters. And I think I saw at the end of this one, they're trying to pull the roommate into being part of the cast.
I really liked that conversation. That was one of my favorite bits of the issue.
The conversation was my favorite part, I do admit.
And that wee line about, who's your family? And it's just me and my dad and my brother. It's like, do you want to drop the bombshell that your brother's in Arkham Asylum? So was that your haul for the week?
Oh, I also had Superboy, which there isn't really a lot to say about it. They're setting him, they're pretty much setting him to be resentful and sulky like they always do. He's going to be a carbon copy of the current Young Justice cartoon pretty soon. I did not realize, and it took me literally four issues to realize this, that one of the characters in it was Caitlin Fairchild. And it wasn't until this issue that I was like, that name sounds really familiar. Where have I heard that name before? And then it hit me. It was Gen 13. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. Wildstorm. So.
Oh, yeah, they're back in.
I was kind of sad to see her. Huh?
Oh yeah, I forgot like that as well. Gen 13 was Wildstorm, so of course that'll be coming back into DC soon.
Yeah, I had not expected that. She was in Superboy and they took her out this issue. I don't know why. I'm kind of curious. I'm actually really interested in her character now. I kind of want them to do something with her. Because now that I've pieced the two together, I'm like, oh, forget about Superboy. Let's focus on her, this redhead. I like her. First one I read. And there are women in that book.
Resurrection Man?
Yeah, there are women in that book. That's all you need to know.
Is that the only comment worth noting about the book?
Well, I was reading it and I was like, I don't know anything about Resurrection Man. I've never even heard of him. I actually asked Alex. I was like, Alex, what's this guy's deal? But I picked it up and I like flipped two pages in and there were women in it. And I'm like, oh, wow, look at these women. They are quite attractive.
They were in a background shot.
So let's just clarify this. Mercy reads Batwoman for the boobs. The only reason she reads Resurrection Man is because there's hot women in it.
I think that's not true. I read Batwoman.
I'm not telling you this.
No, and I will clarify. I am probably the straightest person you'll ever meet. But I prefer looking at a female body rather than a male's body, just because it's prettier looking.
Yeah, men are
It's more interesting for me to see how people draw women as opposed to how people draw men.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I was like, oh, look, there's, and also it's so rare to see women in comics. There's lots of women in comics, but a lot of them are, I don't know.
Yeah, a lot
whenever
of them
I see
are.
Women in a comic book.
Other for a conversation topic in future weeks.
I'm sorry. It's a really good book, and I'll probably read it next time because apparently he died at the end of it. Which I didn't know he was
allowed
to. What?
That was a joke because there's an actual.
I was like, oh no, I'm sorry. Well, you know, his name is Resurrection Man, so I expect him to be back, but you never know.
That's where the book ends.
He dies. Issue 4.
Alright. It died in issue 1 and issue 2 as well, so no bother. Yeah,
okay.
In terms of the books, are you finished, or is there anything else for me?
I'm finished. I'm done. Dang it, I'm
that,
done.
I mean, that's no, the hostile. Are you finished yet?
You can have all the rest of the podcast now, John.
Yes, the John Lee show begins now. in terms of the books I read, I'll try and go through them. I've got them in a pile. I bought 10 books this week. I've only read 8 of them so far. We have Demon Knights.
I read.
I still think this is one of the hidden gems of the New 52. It is such a great book. The art by the I don't know how to pronounce this right. Diogenes Neves is so slick and stylish and classy, and you have Mike Choi filling in to do some dream sequence stuff here as well, and his stuff's so great. And Paul Cornell ties it together with a sharp, witty story. And you talk about Gail Simone building up ensembles. If you're missing Gail Simone's classy ensemble work, then you need to be reading Paul Cornell's Demon Knights. It's much better than Stormwatch. This is the Paul Cornell book I was waiting for the New 52. The perfect showcase for his style. If you like fantasy, you should be checking this out. If you don't like fantasy, this will win you over. Such a classy, great book.
It's interesting because the art reminds me of Oliver Coppola.
Is that Quaffiel, I think? Or...
Yeah, Quaffiel's work on Thor.
Yeah, that. I thought it struck me the similarity to that too.
Yeah, it's just a really good book because I generally don't care for fantasy. Like I'm not the guy to read like anything medieval based or anything. I don't do like D&D or anything, but honestly, like this book's strength is sort of the quiet moments and the humor and just all the character moments, really, is that it's just such a diverse cast of people. You know, you have Jason Blood, Etrigan, who's trying to, you know, get rid of his curse that Merlin placed on him, and there's actually a cool scene in the issue where someone speaks to Merlin. I'm just going to leave it at that. And he kind of grabs him and says, where do you see him? Where do you see him? Tell him to get rid of this curse. I'm sick of being attached to Etrigan. And it's just great. It's a great book.
It's interesting about not being into fantasy, because I'm not a big fantasy guy either, but this year, between Game of Thrones on HBO, which really won me over, and now this, which is one of my favourites, The New 52, I'm starting to get into fantasy. And to bring it back to the idea of women in comics again, this issue has a spotlight on the Shining Knight, who is a great female character in that, like, she pretends to be a man, and the running joke is that She pretends to be a male knight and she thinks she's a master of disguise, but all of the other characters are quite well aware of the fact that she's a woman, but kind of hide it out of politeness. And she has this great dynamic, and she's a really interesting character. You'll learn a lot more about her past in this one. I've told you to check this out already, haven't I, Marcy? Have you relented yet?
I think you told me. I was actually going to ask you, like, what is the premise behind it? I don't know anything about it other than what you guys have said, so...
Basically, it's like a fantasy book. The setup is kind of like Seven Samurai or The Magnificent Seven, where you have a bunch of anti-heroes and outcasts gather in a local village pub, when then the community is placed under siege by this vast war machine, and then these oddball heroes have to unite to save the villagers and stop from killing each other in the same process. And it's a really interesting book.
Yeah,
it sounds right up my alley. I don't know why I haven't picked up.
You should do. That's my recommendation for this week, Mercy. Try Demon Knight.
Okay. All right, fine. I'll go get it.
Do that now. And my next recommendation, next read is Batman and Robin.
Oh,
I read that too.
Yeah, it's such a good book. Sorry. It's a real dark horse. For me, right, I picked up that Detective Comics and Batman issue 1. I dropped Detective Comics after issue 1, and I thought, I'm reading Batman, I don't really need any other Bat titles. But hearing good things about Batman and Robin, I finally relented, and when issue 3 came out, I bought the first 3 issues in one go, and it really surprised me. It's actually almost as good as the main Batman title. I love the relationship between Bruce Wayne and Damian Wayne in this, the father-son dynamic, and I enjoyed the pairing of Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason when they were doing Green Lantern Corps, but Patrick Gleason's art stepped up to a whole other level now. It's a really interesting story, some really interesting characterization. What do you guys think?
I think what's good about it is that it contrasts Scott Snyder's work, in that Scott Snyder deals with sort of Bruce Wayne's character just by himself and sort of the mystery that's surrounding him. But Tomasi is actually putting a lot of work into emphasizing, you know, the contrast between Bruce and Damian, and that they're two very different people, but they're so similar at the same time. Like, there's literally a scene in the book where Damian is at the grave of Thomas and Martha Wayne saying that, you know, your son's a stubborn prick, and it's like, all I could think was like, yeah, said the pot to the kettle.
Yes.
It's like father, like son, so.
I love some stuff with the dog, talking to the dog. There's a little touch of humanity to that, I thought. Because I mentioned this back, I was talking about issue 3, I think it was, where Damien killed the bat and felt bad about it. We see the same thing happening where he kills the firefly or the light bug. And feels bad about that. So yeah, it's interesting just seeing him, like, he's kind of getting a bit more human than when he finally names the dog. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I really love that the Batman and Robin title is quite literal. It's about both of them. What about you, Marcia? What did you think of it?
I was actually surprised because I'm not really into Batman, and I really don't know the character. I used to be into Batman comics all the time, but just recently they did the whole Damon thing, and I was like, oh, this is really stupid. I haven't read Batman in a long time, and I just kind of on a whim got Batman and Robin, and I read it, and I was really, really, really impressed. Just how human the entire book seems to be, and how Damon seems to actually be a character now, and like he acts like a human instead of like this little robot shell that walked around and sulked in the corner. So, yeah.
It shows you there's potential to Damien as being more than just a comic relief, you know. Yeah, he's actually fast becoming, because I wasn't too keen on him at first, but he's fast becoming, you know, one of my favourite Robins, you know.
I think he has potential to be a really good Robin. I'm really biased. I really liked him. I actually used to buy the Robin comic book. So, but I really do like kind of how they're going with him. But again, you know, every writer's different, so I don't know how he's going to evolve in the future. But he's showing, the character is showing a lot of potential right now, and I hope they don't mess it up, because I'm actually interested in a Batman title now, which is surprising.
What I think is great about the Damian character is that he's basically a more extreme version of Bruce in a 10-year-old's body. But the thing is that I don't want to see him evolve into just another Bruce Wayne. Like, I want to see him sort of take what worked with all the different Robins and basically combine them into his own personality. I think that would be a great way to go with the character once he matures.
And I really love it's not as simple as Bruce is right and Damien's wrong, because I think what they're doing is a lot of this stuff is Bruce is kind of failing as a dad in the way he's handling Damien and the way he's responding to him. So he's kind of to blame.
It's like he's overthinking being a dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean,
it's Damien, not like he wasn't like a father figure before, but now he's like, oh my goodness, this is actually mine. And that was kind of what I came away, like I said, I don't read many Batman titles, but that's what I came away with in this issue, was, you know.
Have you been reading the main Batman titles by Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo?
Who, me?
Yeah.
No.
Well, you should try it next week. Add that to
it. Let's see. I picked up every single one of the number ones, and if they didn't impress me for number one, I didn't pick them up again. And I don't think the Batman one impressed me at all.
It's been getting better with every issue. You should pick up issue four.
Okay, fine. Only because you say so.
Yes, do what you're told.
If you pick up Blue Acre.
Blue Acre?
Oh, Blue Estate. Why did I say Blue Acre? I'm really tired. Only if you pick up Blue Estate. You have to pick it up.
Sounds like a deal. Right.
Promise.
Okay, I'll try an issue of Blue Estate.
You heard it here first. Two podcasters pressuring each other into picking up new comics.
Yeah. And moving swiftly on, we have Green Lantern issue 4. Did anyone else read that?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
No.
I don't know. I'm still enjoying it. I think, to me, I'm like, screw Hal Jordan. Let's just make this a Sinestro comic. He's a far more interesting character. Enjoyed the Sinestro characterization and the hints of his regret and having to face the people of Korrigar, who he's done all these terrible things, supposedly in their best interest, and they're saying, well, it wasn't in our best interest because we're a lot worse off now because of you, and him being faced with that and his own weaknesses, and it made for a really interesting dynamic. I think the end cliffhanger, I won't really give it away, but the end cliffhanger was a little bit dubious for me.
That was the main thing that I kind of got out of it, was that, they set up an end cliffhanger, but it's like, we already know how this is going to end based off of the previous issues, so.
Yeah, I don't know, to me it seems like, I'm not sure if, because I was really surprised by how good Green Lantern was when it came back again, because that was a book that was on the threshold of getting ready to get dropped. But since the relaunch, I think it had a real, like, fresh injection of life, but that started to stagnate for me a little bit. As I said, the main issue with me is that Sinestro's a much more interesting lead, and I'd be happy if they killed off Hal and just focused on Sinestro, to be honest. They didn't bother going back to Earth, just had Sinestro flying around space, kicking ass.
I don't know, I like Hal as like a foil to Sinestro. I still think, you have all these people saying, you know, Hal Jordan isn't an interesting character. Like they've been saying that since the beginning.
No, honestly. I mean, I'm actually a defender of Hal. Like, you know, I do think he's an interesting character. I mean, I've played him in RPGs and stuff, but...
Yeah.
I like Sinestro more as he's been portrayed here. And I do like the little touches of characterization with Hal, like his relationship with Carol and his sense of failure with that. Maybe it was a bit harsh now. Maybe don't kill him off just yet. Give him a little more chance to worry.
Every Kyle Rayner fan in the world is like, no, kill him off.
But, yeah, so that was Green Lantern. What about The Shade? Is anyone reading The Shade?
No, I didn't.
So it's only...
I thought about picking it up, but I didn't.
I know it's a lot...
That counts, right?
Yeah, that's just about as good as picking it up, I think. With this issue, I think this kind of suffered because I was talking to Mercedes about half an hour before the podcast started, and she mentioned, "Oh, I've not read a lot of comics this week," and I realised I'd forgotten to read my comics, so I cram read them all, and this was the last one in my cram reading session, so I think it maybe suffered from me not really getting into it as much as I could have. But yeah, it's a really stylish book. I think I mentioned this before, but I've been catching up in the old Starman stuff. I'm still on the first volume of the Omnibus, and it's an interesting read. And so it's interesting reading that while then reading The Shade, because The Shade is easily the most interesting character in Starman. This is him thrown in the centre. Cully Hamner's art is really cool. It's kind of cartoony, but not simple. It's still got a layer of complexity to it. It's a really nice fit to The Shade. Yeah, the story's chugging along nicely. It's kind of going at its own leisurely pace, but there's interesting stuff in here, and The Shade is a cool enough character that James Robinson could probably have him reading the phone book for an issue, and it would still be quite interesting and charming. So yeah, good book, The Shade, check it out. We've also got Frankenstein, Agent of Shade. Did anyone else read that?
I didn't.
No one read.
You are on your own.
On my own again. The story of my life. yeah, I think I'm starting to maybe lose interest in Frankenstein, Agent of Shade. I'm not sure. Me and Serge said the same thing about Justice League Dark, but I think it's kind of like I want to like it more than I actually like it, you know, that way. Where there's an interesting cast of characters, a kind of oddball, but the story itself is kind of shallow. I mean, they have video game motifs where they talk about we have to find the boss who's the big monster to kill him, and they have like characters operating robots using gaming style joy pads, and so it's all feels a bit like a video game. It's all a big fight scene, it's all a bit silly, and like you said with Suicide Squad, it feels like a lot's happening and you don't really have much chance to dwell on anything. I'll still keep it up with now for another issue or two, but as much as I like Jeff Lemire, I might end up sticking just with Animal Man and dropping Frankenstein if the quality doesn't pick up or it doesn't grab me soon. So that's that. And finally, you'll be glad to hear me stop talking soon, we have possibly my favourite book of the week. Not a New 52 book, it's an Image book called Severed. I'm sure I've mentioned Severed before in previous podcasts. It's a horror book. It's co-written by Scott Snyder and his friend Scott Tuft. And it's drawn by Attila Futaki, who I guess is a Japanese artist. It's just such a great, scary book. The way it builds up this slow-boiled dread where the whole time you're reading an issue, you've got this horrible, tight feeling in your stomach like you have like when you're building up to a scary scene in a horror movie, which is a feeling that's really hard to replicate in comics, but it pulls it off. This issue is really interesting because you have a little bit of a wrinkle in the relationship where the salesman character, who has just been presented as this hideous, cruel, one-note, horrible monster, now you get a sense and there might be little flickers of humanity or even decency here and there, and you don't know how much of it is an act to convince the kid that he's picked up, and how much of it is actually genuine. So there's a little interesting wrinkle there, which I wasn't expecting. This is continuing to be one of the highlights of the year for me, and there's only two issues to go, so and we're really getting a sense of entering the end game with how this issue ends. So it's another book where if you've not been picking it up, you're missing out. And either you should really pick up the collected edition when it's all out, or you try and catch up. This is a book you should really check out.
How many issues has it been going for?
This is issue 5 that's came out. It's a 7-issue miniseries. And as I say, Scott Snyder's been doing a lot of great stuff this year. This could be one of his best projects. Really understated. Scary in a Stephen King kind of way. Slow, creeping dread. It's set like in the 1920s in the American frontier. It just has that great classic sense to it. Yeah, definitely worth checking out.
Cool.
And I think I should take a breath now because my throat's hurting from all that talking.
That's...
I will not be checking that out at all. It sounds scary.
Oh yeah, I mean it's a scary book. It's one of the some like scariest comics I've read in a good long while. The fact that Comic Book Resources could do a feature on their website, the top five scariest moments from the first three issues of Severed, and my personal two favourite choices for scariest scene weren't even in the top five, tells you how many frightening moments there are in it. Yeah, it's quite nightmarish and quite horrible. And the thing is, a lot of times in comics, horror means, oh, look at the gore, look at the gore, look at the scary monsters. This actually like makes you genuinely care about these characters. Like, and it's children, it's like the main point of your characters are children, and it builds up these people so you really feel for them and care about them and invested in their safety. It has these horrible things happen to them and they die horribly, you know, and it's really genuinely upsetting to me to do it.
Yeah, that's not a comic book I want to read.
Although I would say it's not a violent book. A lot of the violence happens off-panel, but just the way they build up the dread makes it more upsetting than a lot of books that do have gore.
It figures like your favorite book would have like dying children and stuff.
Yeah. usually the children I kill are a bit younger, but
it's like it's giving you ideas, you know.
Yeah, I actually have a little notebook while I'm reading it. Going, that's a good one. Eat, bite, hang a string of children up and eat them. That sounds good, you know.
Yeah.
But
terrible.
Yeah, Severed, lots of fun for the cannibals in your life.
Lots of fun for the whole family.
Whole family of cannibals.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
It's feel good Christmas fun.
Get Jingle Bell and Severed.
Yeah. Merry Christmas, all the children are dead.
Oh my.
Yeah, so maybe we should go on to our discussion points for the week, because I feel we've been talking for about 3 years about our comics this week. Oh no, sorry, I'm speaking out of turn. Alex, you've still got your books to talk about.
Well, I don't have that many more to talk about, because we've already covered a few that I read, like Batman and Robin and Demon Knights and Green Lantern. But one book that I did read was that I'm about ready to drop. And I feel this was kind of inevitable because it's been kind of declining in quality ever since the first issue. But Deathstroke, the new Deathstroke title.
I didn't fancy that.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of people didn't fancy it because basically the first issue kind of went out of their way to establish, you know, Slade Wilson is the biggest and baddest mercenary ever. And a lot of people didn't really like that.
You mean
that.
He's not?
yeah, no, mustacheless. Deadshot is. But
bring back Deadshot's mustache.
That's exactly. And Amanda
Waller.
One of
the great cats of the new 52.
Oh my goodness.
But honestly, I really love the first issue. Like, it was among one of my favorites, just because I've always really liked the Slade Wilson character, and he's been kind of going on a decline the last few years before the relaunch, and so when he was brought back for this, I felt like it was kind of a return to form in kind of a way. But I don't know. Like, the story really isn't going anywhere. Like, of course, you have the whole idea of, you know, Slade's washed up and nobody respects him anymore. And he's trying to go out and win that respect back by proving...
Killing everyone.
Yeah, basically. Killing everyone. And it's like they try to build up a mystery, like, behind this family that has a... sort of like a rivalry with the Wilson family, and actually employs like these assassins based off of their dead daughter. Like, it's I don't know what to say about it, really, that storyline, but it really just, it isn't that interesting. Like, it just, it's, they try to play it off as more interesting than it is, and it just doesn't work. So I don't know, it's like, I love the art in it. I think Joe Bennett managed to make a terrible costume design look really good in the interior. But, yeah, I stuck with it mainly because of the first issue, because I really liked the first issue. And I think it's like what you said earlier, John, was that you want to stick with a book. You want to like a book more than you actually do like a book. And I think Deathstroke was definitely a case of that for me. So
And I think it's a weakness because I have to try and get over that because I think I should be devoting my attention to the books that are actually good than the ones I want to be good. And that's kind of how comic companies get you. They kind of trade off that wanting to like something and wanting to like a book because it has a character you like in it. So maybe we should be more discerning in our tastes, Alex.
You sound a little accusatory there.
No, I wasn't saying that like you, Alex, meant both of us. Attempt at camaraderie.
No, I totally get what you mean, but... Yeah. But I do feel the first issue was legitimately good. I mean, people had their issues with it, but I was one of the few people who was like, no, I really like the issue. But like just the other issues really haven't compared. Like the second one was basically an elaborate fight scene, and it's really not good enough to hold your interest when you're used to stuff like Scott Snyder's Batman or Demon Knight's. Which are basically chock full of character development. Yeah. So,
a Demon Knight shows that you can have an ongoing fight scene that still has depth and still has character stuff in amidst it.
Yeah, that is true. And just to make this go quicker, I also, for the first time, read Journey into Mystery this week.
Well, cool, I got it, but I've not read it yet.
Okay, so I'm not going to try to spoil anything, but it's a really, like, it's a really fascinating, like, alternate look at the Asgardian mythos of Thor and his family and all that. It's much more of like a, I would say like it's more of an all ages Thor book, but at the same time it doesn't feel like bogged down like some all ages books do. Like it carries an air of maturity about it.
But I think it's embarrassing how much John into Mystery just totally upstages Thor and is better than Thor in every way, pretty much.
who's writing the current Thor?
Matt Fraction.
I mean, I hate to say it because I was really looking forward to his Thor run, but he really hasn't impressed me with any of his Thor stuff.
I dropped because I was reading his first Thor arc. And then when it relaunched as the Mighty Thor, I thought, I'll jump off at this point. And I chose to Journey into Mystery instead by Kieran Gillen, who was writing a better Thor than Matt Fraction back when he did the fill-in arc. Remember when J. Michael Straczynski abruptly left the book unfinished and Kieran Gillen brought in to finish his arc? That ended up being surprisingly good and better than a lot of the stuff JMS had done. And then... Kieran Gillen kind of got unceremoniously dumped to make way for Matt Fraction, who wasn't as good. So I was kind of happy to see Kieran Gillen get a chance to get back to writing Thor and build on the story he was working on and Journey into Mystery. And I like the fact that it's not just a Loki book. He has a whole cast of characters that he's developing subplots for.
Yeah. There is a lot of focus on Loki in the issue that I read, but it's not like... It's not what you'd expect, because it's not adult Loki. It's not evil Loki. Like it's Loki before he kind of became what he eventually became. And I really like the focus on that, because it shows the potential he could have had to be a good person.
Yeah, and that's the interesting dynamic for me, because he's still very much Loki in terms of his scheming and how... witty and manipulative he is, but in a way he's still an innocent as well. He's still a child, you know, so there's still a possibility of him being better, you know. It's the whole nature versus nurture thing.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, the last book that I read this week was Carnage USA number 1, which my feeling on the Carnage character is that, you know, he's basically a symbiote Joker. Like, he's basically always been sort of this mass murderer killer character.
It's the people that thought that Venom was too deep and complex. They decided to make something even simpler than Carnage.
But I read this one out of pure curiosity because they're bringing back the Carnage character for the first time since he was kind of ripped in half by the Sentry.
Death by Mary Sue.
Only Bendis. But, like, they start off with an interesting premise, but at the end of it, the day, it's just an excuse to, I think, put Carnage in a way that makes him seem like a legitimate threat, whereas he already was a legitimate threat. Like, like, they seem to be almost trying too hard to make him, like, more of a villain than he actually is.
Like, it's almost like show, don't tell, don't, like, shows that might actually be in it for a real villain rather than have everyone say, oh, he's so scary, oh, he's so great.
Yeah, because what basically happens is he takes over a town through their drinking water. He infects his symbiote, like, I guess, like, essence of a symbiote into the drinking water of this small town, and all of them become mind-controlled under his will, and they can turn into symbiotes at will.
True.
And
so I'm yawning that.
Exactly. It's basically Carnage P. But the Avengers, like, part of the Avengers come in, and Spider-Man comes in, of course, and confronts him, and basically by the end of it, you know, they're all symbiotes, and it's just, it feels like it's been done before. It doesn't really strike me as interesting. There's nothing really about the book that says, oh, I must read it next week. It's just Carnage being evil, like, and that's it. Like, there's no real depth beyond that. It's like, it's like Joker if you took out the theatricality or the...
Well, didn't you ever see that crossover comic, the Batman-Spider-Man crossover from the 90s?
Yeah,
and the villains were Joker and Carnage. And it's pretty metatextual where the Joker just verbally tears Carnage apart, talking about how, you can't just blow people on. We can't just rip people apart and say you're a villain, you know. With you, it's all about gore, gore, gore. Where's the theatricality? Where's the class?
And what's funny is that Carnage actually looks up to Joker in that issue. So it's a pretty entertaining dynamic. I don't think Carnage really holds up his own book. Like I probably won't read the second issue. So. Yeah, those are my comics for the week, more or less.
In terms of big news of the week, last week we had a sad week in comics where Jerry Robinson died, and this week was more sad news, because we had two deaths in the same day. We had, is it Eduardo Beretta, is that how you say it? The long-time Teen Titans artist. He passed away, and in the same day we heard news that Joe Simon, the creator of Captain America, or the co-creator of Jack Kirby, another one of the all-time legends of the comics world, has died. Like, what age was he? Was it 98?
Yeah, 98.
It's a grand old age. And it's a shame, because when I was at New York Comic Con, there was a Joe Simon panel, and I heard about it, and thought about going, and thought, nah. And I heard afterward it was a great panel where Joe Simon was so witty and engaging and really held, you know, court, you know, enthrallingly, and had some great stories to tell. And now, you know, a couple of months later, he's died, and won't ever have a chance to, you know, hear a man like that speak again. And it's a shame, because even more so again, like I said last week, all of, like, you know, some of the people that were involved in the creation of the industry, pretty much as we know it today, are gone, and that link, you know, like, because one of the things about the comics medium that was interesting was, unlike, you know, books or movies, some of the people that were there at the beginning were still here now, and that's not the case anymore, and it's kind of sad. So I guess, like Serge suggested last week, where we talk about our favourite Joker stories, I guess now it may be quite good to talk about our favourite Captain America stories. Of course, he did much more than Captain America, but that's what he's best known for. And again, it's a shame that in the year... Well, actually, it's not really a shame, I guess, because he lived in 98, it was a good long life. In a way, it's good that he lived long enough to see a Captain America movie be made and be a huge success, and Captain America really break the mainstream and gain a real mainstream following.
I was actually reading yesterday that Joe Simon actually saw the movie and liked it. That was really good.
So I'm glad they had that, you know, and I don't want to say end your life in a hurry, but, you know, that he got, like, you know, to live to see that happen. So yeah, like, in terms of favourite Captain America stories, I'm probably going to cheat and go first, and you're going to hate me when I pick Brubaker's run. I think Bruce running Captain America, particularly the Death of Captain America saga, where Bucky became the new Captain America, is just classic comics. And I don't think it's as good now. I kind of tailed off around the time they had the whole Return of Captain America story. I stopped reading. But at its peak with the Death of Captain America, it was just a great spy comic. The most interesting Captain America's ever been. I've left you guys to a choice now that I've said that.
Well, I mean, that was basically going to be my pick too, but I guess, and this is kind of a weird pick because it's not the traditional Captain America, but the Ultimates, Volume 1.
Right.
With Mark Millar and Brian Hitch. It's, like I said, it's not the traditional Captain America just because it's not like the Boy Scout version of the character. It's not like the do-gooder version of the character. It's a guy that isn't a good guy. Like, honestly, like, when you think about it, the best thing that he does is save the world. His personality says pretty much volumes about the Ultimates as a whole.
He is a bit like, you know, Team America, you know, America, fuck yeah.
Pretty much. It's like, you expect, like, that theme song to accompany every panel he's in.
America.
But, yeah, I think it's still a viable version of Captain America just because I, for a number of years, wasn't a fan of Captain America because I just saw him as a Superman without the powers.
Yeah.
And he didn't really interest me, but once I read Ultimates, like, I kind of got a better understanding for the character. And since Brubaker took over the regular Captain America, I became a bigger and bigger fan of the character, so much so that I think he's in my top 10 now. So,
yeah, I think, like, Brubaker is really, I think, like, and it's good, that's good, especially since he's still writing. How many years has he been writing him now? It must be at least 6 or 7 years Brubaker's been on Captain America.
I think he started in 2004.
Yes, that's like, what, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 8 years
seven
now.
Years. Seven, yeah. Or 8 years.
A math fail. It's a real landmark run. I'm sure, like, Brubaker must already be considered, like, one of, if not the all-time great Captain America writers.
Yeah, at least in modern day, like there are some more classic, like, Kurt Busiek writing him in classic Avengers and
I remember hearing that Mark Waid's run was great as well.
Well, yeah, that is a surprise because, like, it's Mark Waid.
Yeah. What about you, Mercy? Are you a Captain America fan?
I don't know a whole lot about Captain America other than the Ultimate, so
that's right.
I don't feel qualified to say anything about Captain
just
America.
Just silently judge you afterwards.
Okay, it's fine. I do admit that, how do you pronounce the last name? Eduardo Barreto?
Yeah, Eduardo Barreto, yes.
That one kind of pulled some impact on me, him dying, because I remember his Teen Titans, those were the ones that I first started reading when I went into the whole Teen Titans phase that I had. Those are the ones I started with. And so his art for me is always going to be, you know, Titans. And whenever I see the Teen Titans, I always think back to his artwork. So,
and I think
it's
a bit tragic because Joe Simon had a good long life, you know, 98. Eduardo Barreto was, what, 57? That's not old.
Yeah. 57. Not old at all.
You know, actually, before we started recording this podcast, I didn't even know he died.
Oh, yeah, so I forgot to, you know, mention that. Well, with Joe Simon's death as well, I didn't even mention that. Forgot to say,
it comes in threes, remember?
Yeah. It was actually around the same time as this. Eduardo Barreto and Joe Simon have both died.
Yeah, and he died of meningitis, too. That's terrible.
Yeah, it's a real shame.
Regarding Barreto, Eduardo Barreto, I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name, but the one thing I remember about him that I'll probably always remember about him now is that he drew, like, this really classic cover from my childhood, and that it's a Batman and Daredevil team-up book.
Right.
And the cover is just amazing. Like, it's the two of them in silhouette, and it really shows the contrast, like, how two characters that work primarily in shadows, you know, complement each other. And it's a really good study in, like, you know, how impacting you can do with so little. Like, it's basically two shadows, and it's a really good cover. I really enjoyed it.
So, yeah.
I always think about Starfire's hair.
But,
it's all about Starfire's hair.
It's like, you think of Starfire's hair, Batwoman's boobs.
I have to say, we are squeaky clean, innocent folk, and it's...
I can't even look at modern-day renditions of Starfire without seeing that curly hair, like, everywhere.
So, yeah, I think it's just unsafe, you know. R.I.P. Joe Simon and Eduardo Beretta. Again, like I said with Jerry Robinson, you know, you've got a legacy of work that's gonna people are going to be discovering and admiring, you know, long and many years to come. So at least they'll live on through their work. Go moving on, the next topic I guess that we would talk about would be, I mentioned it as Batmania when I was talking about in the podcast notes for potential topics, but basically the fact that we had The Dark Knight Rises prologue debuted in the first 6 minutes of the film, and the trailer leaked online. First, of course, we'll talk about the officially sanctioned thing we should have watched, which was the prologue. I managed to follow that whole viral marketing thing, the Operation Early Bird, and I managed to score tickets to go see a screening of the first 6 minutes at the Glasgow IMAX, and it blew me away. The last thing I went to see in IMAX was The Dark Knight back in 2008, and that was amazing. And I got that feeling watching this again.
The first film that I've ever seen in IMAX was actually Batman Begins.
All right, was that available in IMAX? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was. It was like, I remember like it was really big in IMAX that year. So,
cool.
So me and my dad actually went to see it. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's all right. It was for my own good.
For the good of your throat.
If I had a nitpick, it would be that some of Bane's dialogue was utterly incomprehensible. It just kind of sounded like this. Excuse me?
I liked his accent a lot, though. It's very German.
Yeah, I thought it sounded a bit like Gary Oldman in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy with a Darth Vader.
Don't mention that movie. Oh, sorry. It's not playing anywhere in the United States.
I feel like Street Revenge, all the times us in the UK have to wait for ages for American movies to come out, we got to see Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy back in September. So,
I hate you so much. Anyway, back on top of Batman.
February for Muppets. It was a nice little guest appearance by an actor that if you watch quality TV shows, you'll recognise. I won't spoil who it is because I didn't even know they were in the film, so it was a wee surprise for me. And it'd be nice if other people were surprised when this person appears as well.
I think I already know who it is.
Very stylish. An action sequence which is at least as ambitious, if not more so, than anything that was in The Dark Knight. And this is just the first 5 minutes of the movie. And some of the shots were mind-blowing. And here's a little bit of trivia. It was filmed in Scotland, in the outskirts of Glasgow, I believe, in my hometown, that sequence. So, there you go.
It explains so much now.
You were there.
Yeah.
You were there.
But actually, Tom Hardy came and learned some lessons on how to be menacing from me.
How do I look menacing? And you just gave him, like, an eye. And he was like, okay, that works.
I said, it should speak like this. Because you were sounding a bit confused before. If you sound kind of like Kenny from South Park, it'll be a lot more scary. And if I thought the prologue was great, and then when the next day I spotted leaked online the teaser trailer, which is possibly even better, it's definitely going to look better in HD. Really exciting stuff going on. You got to see some of Anne Hathaway strutting her stuff and some crazy action sequences and a real sense of dread building up for what I like is you really get a sense this is the end. The stakes are impossibly high and no one is safe. So yeah, I think it's quite funny though that I was saying this to my friends I went to see it with, that for me, I was more excited about the prologue for The Dark Knight Rises. That was a bigger movie event for me than any actual movie that's came out this year.
I think what was interesting about the trailer, like the actual trailer that leaked online, was that there's barely any Batman in it. Basically, is that it's more focused on Bruce Wayne, like
that
his,
was interesting for me.
His stakes in it. That's what really caught my interest about it, was that, you know, you have Selina Kyle kind of talking to him about the fact that the city's about to burn and his kind, like all the rich people are gonna suffer in the impact and the crossfire of what Bane's doing. And I thought it was really good because you see Christian Bale like making all of these kind of looks of dread in it.
Yeah. I really like it. It's bringing it back that whole sense that ultimately this series is Bruce Wayne's story.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that's keeping, you know, full circle towards the end. And the interesting thing is now we're talking about Academy Award winner Christian Bale coming back to play Bruce Wayne, which will probably add that little extra bit of prestige to the cast listing. It'll be interesting to see how much Christian Bale gets to strut his stuff and really give like a big performance to wrap everything up, because he got a lot of deserved praise for his performance in the first film, Batman Begins. Second film, everyone focused on Heath Ledger and Aaron Eckhart, and fair enough, I think both of them are brilliant, had amazing performances, but the more I watch the movie, the more I come to appreciate that Christian Bale and Gary Oldman have amazing performances in that film. I'm glad to see that's continuing into film 3, that we're going to have a lot of Christian Bale getting to do some interesting stuff.
Yeah, I think Bale is going to go down as like one of the top people to ever play Batman.
Yeah, surely. I mean,
I've always going to be a Michael Keaton guy, like just based off the fact that I grew up with him. But
I don't want to say he was my first, but Michael Keaton was like the first Batman for me. It was Michael Keaton and there was Adam West.
That's actually the same thing with me, is that I watched the Tim Burton film and then I discovered Adam West later on.
The interesting thing for me though is that Christian Bale, right, because I'd kind of drifted away from Batman a bit, like at the time before Batman Begins came out, if I was into any comics it was more Marvel stuff, but Christian Bale was a lot of people became fans of Christian Bale because he was cast as Batman, but for me, Christian Bale being cast as Batman was what got me interested in Batman again, because at the time, Christian Bale was one of my favourite actors. The performances, and you know, as Patrick Bateman in American Psycho was what at the time I'd rank as my single favourite performance in any movie, and even now it's still up there. So I was really excited to see what he would bring to the character of Batman. I think he brought like a real credibility to the role. But people still make fun of the, you know, this man's a voice like this. He says he must have friends. And I have laryngitis. Yeah. But
Where is he? He must have friends.
But like people make fun of the Bat voice. But
and what's funny is that now people have a different voice to make fun of. You know, with the.
What are you saying? I can't make it out.
Your voice is very deep.
People make fun of that, but it's a great nuanced performance. And although it's probably an extreme long shot, I would really like to see if come Oscar season, like, you know, Christian Bale got a nomination to recognise the work he's done over three films. I know it's incredibly unlikely, and probably hoping for even a Best Director and Best Picture nomination is probably going to be optimistic, but I would like to see...
Yeah, unfortunately, the Academy seems pretty biased when it comes to comic book films.
I think it's got a good chance of a Best Picture nomination, if only because they changed the Best Picture category to include 10 films, largely because of the extreme backlash of The Dark Knight not getting nominated.
Yeah.
It might get a token nomination. Whether it wins or not is another story, but I think that's a good chance of at least getting nominated.
As long as the film, you know, turns out pretty good. Who knows?
Yeah, but I've kind of anticipated for granted the film's not going to suck, but I'm kind of confident it's going to at least be good. I don't know if it'll top The Dark Knight, because I know I'm biased, because The Dark Knight's my favourite film of all time, but I don't think it will top The Dark Knight, but I do think that it's going to be good enough to break the third movie curse, and it'll be a worthy end to the trilogy, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? Maybe the footage that Nolan released is only like the only serious parts, and the rest of it's like a slapstick comedy.
Yeah, I still think the whole thing should end with a musical number, where, like, you know, Bane and Batman hug and make up, and they lead the whole of Gotham in a rousing rendition of "I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas."
Oh,
and they go, "Goodbye, everybody," you know.
Oh,
and then that's it.
Oh,
yeah. Just like the ones I used to love.
Sounds like whales.
That, I think that
sound like whales.
Yeah, you think that's what he was going for? but yeah, so that was Batmania, and I'm sure we'll be hearing lots more Batman stuff in the months to come. But what else was we wanting to talk about again? We've been talking long enough, or do we want to talk about Image?
I don't know. Do we want to talk about Image?
Well, yeah, maybe
we seem to be reading a lot of Image books recently, all of them.
Well, maybe mention it briefly, but Eric Stevenson, publisher of Image, posted up on his blog a kind of like slightly snarky mockery of Marvel and DC, where he posted, "Marvel has announced that the next big thing from the House of Ideas is a new version of this," and he posted an old 1980s cover of the X-Men versus the Avengers. And then "Meanwhile, DC is, by most accounts, gearing up to multiple new versions of this." Then he posted a Watchmen cover. He said, "Image Comics is on a supersonic rocket ship to the future." There's hyperbole if I've ever heard it. "However, and so next year we're going to be doing this," and he showed a whole lineup of their books coming up in the next couple of months. You have Fatal by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. You have Thief of Thieves by Nick Spencer and Robert Kirkman. You have Saga, the new book by Brian K. Vaughan. And you have The Manhattan Projects by Jonathan Hickman. And some of these books, I think it's quite, you know, big name creators. A lot of guys that have worked at Marvel or whatever, that are doing their own creator-owned projects. And the one I'm probably most excited about is Fatal by Brubaker and Sean Phillips. So I was reading Chew, and I saw a trailer for it. They actually had a trailer for a comic in the back of it, and it was done a bit like a film trailer, where it had like little clips and segments from the comic, interspersed with critics' quotes. And I love the fact that, based on the back of Criminal and Sleeper and Incognito, that kind of Brubaker and Phillips, the pairing of the two names, came like kind of a watermark of quality, where they can sell a book just based on their names. You don't have to have like Batman or a character, it's the creators that sell the book. And I quite respect that, actually.
You know, I actually don't read much Image. I knew nothing about the announcement. But honestly, I think it's interesting enough that creator owned books in general, like whether they're from Marvel or, you know, Image or whatever company, is that most of them tend to be very, very good. Like when you let a writer be free, you know, give him to his own freedom, creative freedom, you know, it tends to be much more well received, I think. So Image doing a lot of them, you know, it seems like a good business strategy.
Yeah, I think the amazing success of The Walking Dead this year is showing that. I think it's kind of showed a lot of creators that, you know, yeah, it might be more of like an investment and less like immediate success, but if you put the work into making your own ideas, if they launch and really take off, you know, and get some crossover appeal, you're the one that reaps the awards. You know, it's not like Marvel and DC's Reflected Glory, like, you know, you have it all yourself. I'm actually going to post a link. You can maybe go in the show notes, Alex, when you're putting it together.
Okay.
A friend of mine, Joe Mulvey, wrote this really great column about creator-owned comics and why you should want to buy them, that sums up. And I've been kind of trying to do a bit more like experimenting with creator-owned books. I've been trying more of Image books. I want to try Witch Doctor, which was one of the new Image books of this year. I'm going to give Fatal and maybe Saga a try. I've been trying Severed. Yeah, I'm just going to try and like spice up Marine Lift a bit, and try some new voices and some different type of books and see if they win me over, especially since I'm trying to establish myself as a creator-owned creator. That makes sense. So I should be kind of like talking, walking the walk.
Yeah, we should probably say the best creator-owned book is The Standard.
Yeah, The Standard has some obviously marvelous writing. I hear the writer is handsome and witty and charming. And the art's quite good as well. Yeah, see, Mercier agrees, of course. check out The Standard as well, by all means. Standardcomics.com, hint. just in general, I think 2012 is going to be a really interesting year for creator-owned books. You have, like, all this lineup of comics coming from Image, and I'm hopefully going to have a couple of projects being unleashed as well, which I'll use this podcast to pimp once I can tell you more. I think I'm just talking to talk right now, so I'll shut up.
I really love Image. I don't read them steadily, but I think my first Image comic was actually Fell by Warren Ellis. Ennis. I know how to say it. And it's a good comic. And I love Image. I really like reading the companies that aren't DC and Marvel. I was a huge fan of CrossGen. And while it lasted, I was a huge fan of Speakeasy. And I also bought a bunch of the Virgin comics, too. So, I mean, I'm all for the creator-owned ones because I think they can explore so many more genres than they can in DC or Marvel without people being like, oh, this doesn't seem like a DC book. Mostly DC and Marvel, to me, they're the superhero titles.
Yeah. I mean, I
sometimes
should,
goes
yeah,
outside
I mean,
the...
Hero comics can't really say that much, but it's interesting to see there's more to comics than superheroes. You know, any genre you can do in film or TV or books, you can do in a comic pretty much. And Image lets you see some of that diversity. And seeing like all stuff getting handled.
Yeah, I've noticed that most of the comics I have on my list for the coming months are Image comics. So,
are you reading Chew?
Image or Dark Horse? What?
Are you reading Chew? Are you reading the comic called Chew?
Chew. No, I did pick up Chew 22, and I got like halfway through it, and then I lost interest. I think I need to go back and read the other. I need to back read the issues because I just didn't get all of it. It seems really good though. But
yeah, it's a great comic.
Comics I've picked up recently, I really, really love a lot. I think I would say I like them better than the DC comics I've been reading.
Yeah, I think Image is definitely some interesting stuff happening over there, and I think next year's going to be a really cool, interesting year for them with some heavy hitter creators. Definitely, because while, like, you know, I really like seeing new creators kind of like being discovered by Image, but it's also interesting to see a lot of guys that are working like in Marvel and perhaps aren't like, you know, getting to show their stuff as best as they could in Marvel, are saying, well, why not try doing some creator own stuff for Image? So it's almost like the big guns, like, you know, launching stuff and it's been built on their names, you know. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
I'm really excited. I've noticed, I don't know if any of this is kind of deviating into different conversations. It's more accessible now to get their comics. Oh, I know that my local comic book store doesn't always carry comics other than DC.
Yeah, totally. And it's quite hard at times because, like,
there's more of them out there, and I think Image and Dark Horse, to a certain extent, already have, like, the autonomy to be able to do the different genres. It's super awesome that more of the artists and writers are doing their own projects now.
Yeah. Oh, another Image book I should mention, The Strange Talent of Luther Strode. I think I mentioned it last week.
Mentioned it once or twice.
Yeah.
I have not looked at it yet.
That's another great Image title. 6-issue miniseries. That's a new talent, Justin Jordan. I think this is his first comic. And really cool debut. I think that's probably about enough. I think I've probably blabbered on long enough. so maybe we should wrap this thing up.
Okay.
Any final thoughts anyone wants to offer for the week?
The fire rises.
Right. Yeah, the fire rises.
It's
I've got a sore throat. Mercy likes boobs, and Alex has no life. sums up what we did this week. I think I'm quite proud of that show. I think we did quite well. I think we really need to tell Serge he doesn't need to ever come back. We handled this quite well.
We're going to be great on the 30th without him.
Yeah, we have a great time, a grand old time. So yeah, if you've lasted this long, congratulations, you're a trooper. This has been the Off-Panel Podcast, and your hosts have been Alex Campbell.
See you later.
Mercy Mueller.
Bye.
And I'm John Lees. Good night, and good luck.